What's up, y'all, and welcome back to Found Bites, a game review series. My name is Brian, and I'll be your host. If you don't know about us, we're all about finding and testing out small, high-quality video games. This is a podcast that aims to respect your time and money as a gamer and a consumer by sifting through storefronts and sales to find those gems that may be worth your precious resources. But enough about the show. Let's get into our next game. Bloodless is the game for this week's episode. Bloodless is a 2024 retro action-adventure game from developer Point and Sheep, and it was originally released in August of 2024 on PC through Steam, and then eventually in October it came to Switch, and so it's just on Steam and Switch for the moment. What drew me about this game, honestly, is everything. The setting is like a feudal Japan, there's samurai, there's ronin, there's all kinds of things that you would expect to be there. Visually, it's really interesting because it's like retro pixels. It almost presents like a Game Boy Color game, like a top-down adventure going through a Game Boy Color game. And the gameplay is very Sekiro-based, so it's countering, it's parrying. And in addition, there seemed to be a lot of depth with exploring, finding different skills, upgrading your character, getting different things. So all of that really spoke to me. After playing through the game, I will say very steep learning curve. So I compared it to Sekiro, maybe a little bit to Trek to Yomi, but honestly, this difficulty does spike very quickly and it can be brutal and you can be slamming your head against a wall. You really have to learn what this game is about. You can't brute force it. You have to play it as it expects you to. And so that might be something that deters a lot of people. It is difficult, but I find it very rewarding because I like those kind of games. Initially, I saw this on Twitter, I think over the summer, and I really locked in on it because just right away from the trailer, I saw it and I was like, yes, I have to play this, and I don't know when it's going to come to anything. Honestly, I hadn't heard anyone talk about it, so I kind of just one day thought like, oh yeah, what about that game Bloodless that I saw on Twitter? And so I searched it up and I found that it was only on Switch. And then so I just kind of jumped on it. The MSRP is $14.99. I got it on Switch. I really couldn't wait once I realized that it was there. And so I didn't wait for a sale or anything. I paid $14.99. It's a relatively short game. Should take anywhere between 8 to 12 hours. At least that's what the devs say. Definitely 12 more on the end of exploring a lot and getting all the extras that you can find in the game. I am pretty much at the end of the game, and you get to a point where you can kind of explore and collect all the things or do all the challenges that you didn't before. And so I went and I did all those things. I beat all the dojos. I'm probably at about 10 hours, but I think I'm at like the place where it's like, all right, now we need to go do the final boss or whatever. Really surprised that no one's talking about this game more, especially from the standpoint of like a physical edition. I haven't seen anything, but I can just smell it. A game like this, people love feudal Japan. People loved Sekiro, Ghost of Tsushima, that aesthetic and parry-based, you know, countering, stuff like that. I feel like more people need to know about this because they will definitely eat this up. And I feel like a physical gameophiles would certainly love to have something on their shelf for this. And the game was developed by Point and Sheep. Never really heard of them. They're a small team, maybe about five or six of them. I've seen a couple of their small games just on their website. Never heard of them, but I really think this could be a breakout title for them. So I was very excited to dive in.
We'll be right back.
All right, let's talk gameplay for Bloodless. So the view that you're going to have, it's kind of like this top-down at an isometric angle. What that means is you're going to be able to walk behind things. You're going to be able to walk under like different underpasses or bridges. And so that perspective is going to remain constant. Pretty basic movement. You move with the joystick. You can run. So there's a button that you hold to run, and this will decrease your stamina meter. So in the top left corner, you'll have a white bar. That is your stamina meter. And as you do things that will take stamina, it'll slowly go down. And then if you let it go or don't do anything, it'll slowly recover. If you bring it all the way down, it will turn red, and then you can't do anything that requires stamina until it's fully recharged. Nothing really new here. Dash is something else that you'll be able to do. This will take a chunk of stamina, and it's primarily going to be used in combat, and there's really no cooldown for this. In fact, I found that you could do 3 or 4 dashes in succession as long as you have enough stamina in the stamina meter, and so that's really nice, especially in combat, because you are going to have instances where enemies do attacks, and you have to really get out of the way if you don't want to get hit. You're going to be walking around and interacting with things, so a prompt will come up. This is primarily to talk to NPCs, maybe read signs, and access save points once you get in front of them. And then some more advanced things. Eventually, we will talk about combat, but there'll be a button to drink a gourd, which is like your potion, which kind of functions like an Estus flask, or cycle through them with the D-pad. You'll have access to key attacks, which is another one of the face buttons on the Switch. And this will be something that we use in combat. Again, we'll talk about that in a second. Eventually, you'll get access to special moves, and you can cycle through them with the bumper buttons. But pretty early on, you realize that your key attacks or your dash can be used to kind of attack objects in the world. And this is going to be important because when you hit them, whether it's barrels, whether it's different flowers, you'll be able to collect currency or collect different items that allow you to craft the consumables that go in your gourds. So traversing in this game, this will function very similarly to games we've talked about recently, like Nobody Saves the World, and compared that to Trigger Witch, or even older games like A Link to the Past. You're moving screen to screen, and sometimes the screen will scroll with you, but when you reach the edge of it, the screen will stop moving and you'll go to the edge, and then it'll kind of blacken away and it'll go to a load screen, and then you'll go to the next area on that side. You'll also see this if you see buildings and the doorways are open. You can walk in the doorway and the screen will go black, and then it'll reappear and you'll be inside the building. But a lot of how you're getting around, or at least how the game is gating you from area to area, is through combat encounters. So you're mostly going to run into these and get trapped. In fact, I think every combat encounter, you will be trapped until you finish it or beat all the enemies. But once you beat it once, for some of them, you'll be able to run past them if you come up to it again. But that'll really only apply to later in the game. And so you're traveling screen to screen, sometimes onto a load screen, and you'll be able to look at the map. And the map is going to be these small areas. And there's maybe 7 or 8 in the whole game, but they're small areas. And so when you're going to the edge of a screen and moving on and hitting a load screen, that's pretty much when you're loading between the map areas, but sometimes some of them are big enough that like you'll have a load screen within them and you'll go to another screen even though it's on the same map area. You will get fast travel in the game. It's helpful primarily because you can go back to sort of like the main central town or location where you'll have a certain NPC who sells you things and you'll want to go back there a few times. But honestly, these are few and far between. There's maybe only 5 in the game, which is not that much. Luckily, the map is small. It reminds me a lot of Lamentum, a game we talked about way back when, where it's like, honestly, you could run through a lot of these areas after you beat them and not worry about the fast travel. But it is nice to sort of get a lay of the land, or like, oh, that's the central location. Like, that's where I need to get back to constantly. So it's nice to have that fast travel once you discover the points. And let's talk pacing in the game. So I would say the game is fairly linear. Every time you have sort of the main quest progressing, you'll see a marker on the map. It's like a red X, and it's basically saying you need to go there to progress the story. I will say there's a surprising amount of extras and exploration. It's more on the mid to late side of the game, but I was pleasantly surprised, especially near the end of the game. I'm like cleaning up a lot of extras or things that I can find. But like I said, it's mostly linear. It's a pretty limited path that you're walking on, and you'll see it vaguely as you look at the map screen for some of the areas. Like, it is limited where you can go, but regularly throughout even early game, you will have sort of branching paths where it's like, hey, I could go this way and see what's over here. So I like that it is linear, but it does feel like, hey, you have some options here if you want to explore a little bit. You will find side quests. Most of these are combat challenges, but some of these might be like a light collecting thing, like find this thing or go find this person. And these are going to be nice because they're going to give you rewards, and these rewards could range from currency to different upgrades. There is some inconsistency with the difficulty, I would say, on the main quest or the side quest. I found that like mid-game, there were a couple places I could go. One was clearly the main path. One was clearly like a side or optional thing. And with the difficulty, I found myself bouncing off of both of them. And that happened a couple times. Like I would go down and be like, oh, this is a side thing I can do. And it's like, I just can't do it right now. It's too tough. I don't know if I need to upgrade more. And so it can get a little frustrating. I do understand that it encourages sort of like the diversity of the path or what you can find or the different upgrades, but I feel like that's pretty limited in such a small game. So it left me a little frustrated, I guess, but I can also understand that it does make it feel like you're not missing anything. Like you could do the side quest or you could keep continuing with the main quest, and that it's always kind of there for you when you get your next upgrade and feel like you're good enough to progress in that direction. The combat encounter difficulty is very interesting. I would say it starts fairly linear in the first few hours, and then all of a sudden it just shoots up. Again, I do think there's some inconsistency with the difficulty on the main or the side quest, but in general, for many reasons, it really steeps in terms of difficulty. I did find myself hitting a wall a bunch of times, but I kind of kept back at it and plugged through it. I really think this is because you're introduced to enemy types, at least in the beginning, at a nice pace, and then all of a sudden you start to encounter like upgraded versions of those similar enemy types, and then they all kind of get thrown into the mix. And so what it's creating are these unique combinations of enemies in the different encounters, and honestly, it's really hit or miss. I think this will vary player to player, like what enemies or even what combinations of enemies are more difficult or just make you want to bash your head against the wall. I'd be really interested to hear from other players, like what enemies or what combinations of enemies are giving them a lot of difficulty. Because as somebody who I would consider myself a From Software veteran, I know that with certain bosses, there are always ones that like a lot of people struggle with, but they're really is every boss that someone is struggling with, and then at the same time, someone else is just flying right through. So I think that could apply here. But in that respect, with that difficulty and sort of the inconsistency, again, very From Software, very Sekiro, certainly with the combat that we'll talk about in a second, but also a game that we talked about before, Trek to Yomi. I feel like there's a lot of similarities here because some of those encounters had unique combinations of enemies, and the way they were coming in was just, I could not get past it. It took me like 20, 30 tries. Some similarities here. But I think what's interesting about this game is you really have to play the game how it wants. I'm reminded of Sekiro because a lot of people who play From Software games wanted to, you know, maybe play it their own way, but it was really a game that was begging you to play it the way that it was presented. And I think this game is similar, because you have to minimize your stubbornness. You can't go in with a full head of steam. You can't brute force your way through these combat encounters. So let's get into the combat, because it is a bit complex. And I'll say at the top with the combat, the goal here is to be passive yet aggressive. And I know that seems counterintuitive, but it is a cross between Sekiro and Bloodborne, because you want to be aggressive like Bloodborne, but at the same time, you're reacting to enemies attacking. So you are being passive. You are waiting for them to do something to know what you're going to do, because the game is counter parry based. And so patience is the key, not overexerting yourself and not being too much on the offense. So the basic goal whenever you have an enemy encounter is to quote unquote disarm enemies, which is essentially killing them and rendering them useless because they run away because you've disarmed them. But you're not killing them. The game is very clear about that, and we'll talk about that when we get to the vibe. But you do this by breaking the stance of the enemy. And sometimes you only have to break an enemy stance once. Sometimes you have to do it twice. Sometimes enemies will have multi-phases, and you might have to do it in certain sequences or certain combinations of their moves. So it's very interesting, and every enemy is fairly unique with that. And the way that you're going to learn about how to do this has to do with what color the attack the enemy is doing. So there are color-coded attacks. They're either going to be white or red. And so when an enemy attacks and their swipe is white, basically that means you can break their stance in that attack with a timed dash. So as soon as they swipe their sword or their club or whatever, you can dash at them and that will break their stance. Now again, Simple enemies versus advanced enemies. Some enemies, if you do that once, they're gone. That's it. But sometimes you might have to do it a couple times in sequence. Sometimes you might do it once to an enemy and then it makes them start their second phase. So it really does vary. And like I said, there are going to be enemies and then sort of upgraded versions of them that will do similar things, but more advanced. And then if an enemy attack is red, this is interesting because you cannot dash through it. In fact, if you do, you'll get hit and you'll take damage. But the goal when an enemy attacks in red is either to avoid it, like dash away and get out of the way, or to use timed key attacks. So like we said, one of the face buttons is going to be for key attacks, and this is like an active punching that you're doing, but it's really not meant to actually attack the enemy. It's meant to counter their red attacks. And so the goal here with your key attacks is to key attack before they do the red attack. And when you do that, it could potentially interrupt them and it'll drain their stance meter. So a whole lot of stuff right there. Let's break it down. Let's unpack that. So anytime an enemy attacks, right before they do the swipe, you'll see like a gleam or a star. It's like a circle. It almost looks like the Smash Brothers like melee logo or something like that. But you'll see like a star shining and it'll also come alongside with sound effects, which is very helpful. And it will be either white or red. And what that is doing is it's telegraphing the enemy's next attack. And so you have a short window to do that key attack. And in fact, I'm not sure of the exact timing that you need. I think some enemies that are more advanced might require like a stronger key attack or in sequence or something like that in order to actually interrupt them. But whether you're doing it right before their red attack or just while they're standing there in between attacks, anytime you hit them with a key attack, you're going to deplete their stance meter. And what that is above every enemy, once they've been hit by a key attack, you will see their meter show up and start to have been depleted. And anytime in between attacks, that meter is quickly going to tick back up. But the goal with that is to drain it all the way down. Once you drain an enemy's stance meter all the way down, they'll kind of sit there in a daze, and then they will, just like a white attack, be open to a dash. And they'll be sitting there, and if you hit them with a dash there, that's the equivalent of doing the same stance break as with a white attack. Now, what's really tough is, like I said, that stamina meter, if you get it down at all, it's slowly ticking back up to be full. But anytime an enemy hits you with an attack that you don't dodge or that you don't get out of the way of and you take damage, they will regain like a larger chunk of that stance meter. So this is super complex here as I'm explaining it, I understand. But basically, you're trying to disarm an enemy by either stopping their regular attack, the white attack, or trying to interrupt their own attacks. And it's interesting with the key attacks because sometimes I feel like that is the equivalent of trying to brute force. Because if you try to chip them with the key attacks a little bit here, a little bit there, you can get that stance meter down and then eventually dash through them and break their stance. But some enemies attack with such vigorous sequences that it doesn't leave enough windows for that, and you do have to counter their attacks. You do have to time it before a red attack and not just chip them when they're standing there. Eventually, you will get special key attacks, and these will have sort of like an increased meter drain plus an effect. Like there's one key attack where you can use it and it'll dash you from very far away and hit them with a key attack. That's really good at timing it to interrupt their attack before a red attack. And then there are others like it'll do a bigger slash, but you'll dash away. So there are a lot of interesting special key attacks that you get. But this kind of introduces another mechanic, which are these petals that are in the top right corner. And anytime you use a special key attack, you'll deplete one or two of the petals. And if you don't have enough, you won't be able to use that special attack. But what's interesting is if you ever dash through or break a stance on a white attack, you actually regenerate petals. So it's a very involved combat system that's synergistic, but basically it all gets back to breaking the enemy stance, and you can do it two ways. You can do it reacting to their white colored attacks, or you can slowly drain their stance meter and do it that way. And speaking of the enemies in this game, so wide variety here. Some are very simple and have a specific melee combo that they do that involves you just parrying one of their white attacks and all of a sudden they're done. Or like I said, some of them will have a sequence. Like some of them you'll have to hit them on their white attack and they'll get pushed back, and then they'll come at you with another quick white attack. And if you hit them both in sequence, then that'll disarm them and they'll run away. And other have more advanced sequences, like they'll try to hit you with a white attack, and if you dash through that, they'll back up and then come at you with a red, and you have to get out of the way, and then they'll come back again with a white. And you have to hit both of the whites in that sequence to fully disarm them. So it can get very complex, but you will get used to it as you die to them and know what's coming. So you'll have big guys that do similar things. Sometimes you'll have them drop boulders that can harm you, but also that you can dash through them and try and deplete their stance meter with that. A lot of enemies are going to shoot projectiles, and they will either be colored white or red. So if they're white, that means you can dash at them and deflect them. If they're red, that means you can't. And you'll get enemies that do a combination of melee and projectile, and interesting sequences where they throw something in red and then they come at you with a white melee attack. And we talked about their stance meter. Every enemy is going to have a varied size on their stance meter. Some of the early ones are going to have very small ones, and you can just punch them with a couple key attacks and easily get them to daze and dash through them, and they're done. But like I said, what makes these combat encounters really interesting and difficult is the mix of enemies, the different incoming attacks, and the timings of the sequences of these different enemies. It's not like your games of old where if a couple enemies are coming at you, like I think of Ocarina of Time with like the dinosaur knights in the Fire Temple. Like, it's not like one of them is going to engage with you and the others are going to stand around and be like, yeah, let's make it a fair fight. No, you're going to have enemies peppering attacks at you. And so sometimes you'll have three or four enemies in an encounter and you have to gauge and time their different attacks as they're coming to you. So it can really be cacophony of attacks coming at you. And sometimes the space is limited in these encounters. So it really elevates the complexity here. And what's even more difficult is some of these encounters are going to have multiple waves of enemies. So the first wave might have two or three simple enemies and you get rid of all of them. All of a sudden you get two big guys coming in the next sequence. Towards the end of the game, you might have sequences of three different waves of enemies that you have to beat in that sequence. Like, you can't die in between and come back and, you know, you're at the third wave. You start at the first wave each time. And so in terms of accessibility, encounters are really tough. And I think that might deter some players. But again, if you're a veteran in these types of games, or if you, you know, like bashing your head against a wall or like ball busting encounters, like some of these I got through in like three or four tries. There were a couple encounters, especially with the dojos near the end, that took me like 20 times to get it because it's multiple waves and some of the toughest enemies. Some of the tougher ones, I will say, were the optional ones, like I said, the dojos, but like some of the main ones towards the end of the game were really, really tough. And so I don't know what is going to alleviate that person to person. I do think if you're someone who likes these types of games that are super challenging, you might have to pivot within yourself, like some kind of stubbornness. You need to relinquish, like, okay, this is a passive game and you're going to have enemies coming at you and you need to be reactionary instead of trying to bum rush. And there are certainly some encounters that seemed insane at first. I was audibly yelling, like, how could I possibly get through this? But eventually I conquered it. And so games like this really attest to fortitude that might not be for everyone. I will say the save point frequency is nice. Pretty much before and after most encounters, you'll have that save point, which is nice. You go up to it, you fully recover your health, your stamina, your ki pedals for your ki attacks. And when you're there, you can change some of your equipped stuff. You can refill some of your gourds, which is actually crafting. So like I said, you're picking up crafting supplies for different gourds. So you have healing gourds, but then you'll get some special ones that are like, use this to have your stamina be infinite for 20 seconds, or your ki attacks to do more stance or stamina damage or whatever. So you're using collected items from the environment. So you will find that you should be constantly farming when you see them. But whenever you die, you will respawn at the last save point you were at. What is a little annoying is that you have to manually craft and refill your gourds, which is frustrating if you come from like From Software games, like especially Sekiro, like things like that would automatically refill. It is a little tedious at first, but you get used to it and it doesn't really take long. I just hope that you're out there collecting a lot of the materials so that you don't run low. I didn't get too low ever. It wasn't like a Bloodborne situation where I ran out of blood vials and had to farm them. As long as you're walking through the areas and anytime you see them, you're farming, you should be fine. And finally, just to elaborate more on your character. So like I said, you have a stamina meter up at the top. You also have a health bar that has individual bars. Anytime you get hit by an enemy, you'll lose one of the bars. You will find and equip crests throughout the game, and some of these are interesting. Like, one is like your dash uses less stamina, or you're, like I said, you're able to kick boulders. One that I got that was like absolutely mandatory in my eyes was your healing flasks double their effectiveness. So instead of using a healing flask and it only giving you back one health bar, it'll give you two. That's like a major game changer in my opinion. And crests use like a maximum allotment, similar to like Paper Mario, like your badge points. So each of the crests cost a different amount to equip. Some might cost one or two or three. And depending on how many maximum of the crest points that you have, you can only fit certain combinations of the crests that you own. You will upgrade a lot of things in this game, your max HP, your stamina, the amount of petals, the crest space, all kinds of things like that. And you can get these upgrades by just finding them, either going throughout the main quest and arriving at a point where it's just sitting there, or completing a side quest as a reward, you'll get it. You'll also be able to purchase a lot of these. Interesting about the purchasing things, I really feel like there's a bottleneck of currency where, like, I couldn't just keep buying things. I really was bottlenecked in terms of how much currency I had. Late in the game, I'm able to buy a lot more, but even still, I'm not, like, loaded with money, so you have to choose wisely what you spend your currency on, because it's not necessarily everywhere. But I do like that there's sort of an equal pace of being able to buy things, finding the optional challenges in the dojos or the side quests, as well as finding these upgrades on the main path. So I do like that that's sort of equally split, so it's not like you can buy your way through or explore your way through. You kind of have to do a little bit of everything to upgrade your character. All right, let's talk vibe for Bloodless, and let's start with the visuals. So definitely a lot of Game Boy Color aesthetic here. You see the pixels. Definitely reminds me of Under Dungeon, especially the characters, but just like the black and white and then colored in. Your characters are all going to be like white with black outline, but they'll all have some kind of color accessory. And I think the color has significance. I don't know. You can probably discern that just by what color specific characters might be wearing. And so speaking of the characters, you do see like some vague expression on their face, I feel. I think you might need to adjust sometimes to focus on their different features, like visually adjust your eyes. The environment's really beautiful and a lot of color, although it is light dark, like you will see a lot of lanterns where like around them you'll see the color, but then when things are dark, it's like a dark gray. But a lot of floral things going on, a lot of trees, leaves, certainly the plants that you're picking up, like you'll see the matcha leaves, the cherry trees and whatnot, ginger you'll pick up. It is a colorful environment and the buildings are really nice. Again, a lot of Japan-inspired, like wooden bridges, Shinto arches, the houses with like the sliding doors and whatnot, the dojos that you see, very true to Japanese architecture. And again, rich with color and detail. What I really like is, like I talked about at the top, like you will see that dimension where like you are walking under bridges as well as walking across them. So there is that level of things being in front of you or you being behind things. And what's interesting about the environments is the stark contrast to the characters. Because like I said, your characters, whether it's you or the enemies, you're kind of all white with black outlines of the features and then maybe some color detail. But the environments around you are colorful and the ground is super dark. Sometimes it's black, sometimes it's a dark green. Even when you're in the water, it's like dark green, even the dark green lily pads that you see. But this is really nice because it allows the enemies and the characters to stand out, especially in combat, because you're going to need that. As well as with the indicators, you know, we talked about like the color of the attacks, like the little gleam or the star before an enemy attacks. Like you need to be able to see that, and it translates that very well because it's significant for the timing. And just speaking of timing is sort of like an aside, I'm playing this on the Switch and sometimes the Switch chugs to play this a little bit. Sometimes if there's multiple enemies on the screen, there might be a little bit of a delay. Sometimes I was dashing at a white attack, and it said I got there later when the attack changed to a red attack. So just be aware of that. I didn't experience too much of that, and I wasn't too frustrated about that, but I definitely did notice it. And in terms of audio, sound effects are a big thing in this game. Like I said, the timing with the indicators, not just visually, but a nice little like shing or whatever, whenever there's a gleam before an enemy attacks, very helpful, especially if, you know, the visuals are chugging on the Switch. Really like some of the, you know, Japanese or Eastern Asian inspired, like, you know, kung fu sound effects or things like that. Like whenever the battle starts, it sounds like it's, you know, a martial arts movie, or whenever you find an item, it's like ding, 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 ding. Really nice stuff like that that really adds to the environment, as well as just like clanging of swords or enemies groaning when they're quote unquote disarmed. The music was good. I liked it. It's kind of low in the background, not too invasive or intrusive, mainly just tense when you're in battle and kind of like soft whenever you're not. But again, kind of alongside the sound effects, typical sounds that you might hear, like, you know, flutes or whatever. Nothing major stand out in terms of like an emotional score or anything like that, but definitely nice and apropos for what the game is trying to deliver. And then finally, in terms of like themes and setting, obviously, we're talking about feudal Japan. The audio really adds to that. The different buildings visually that you're seeing. Always talk of samurai and ronin and shinobi and all the different attacks that you see, the swords that you'll see. A lot of that stuff that you would expect, it really comes through right at home. And then the themes alongside that, like honor and family and the family name and the clan and being loyal, or what you used to be versus who you are now. And this especially shows up in your character, Tomoe, who is an old samurai, but she's come back after a long time. And so she abandoned them, but she's changed her ways. So a lot about that, like a haunted past or her reputation and who she is now. The idea of nonviolence is a big thing, and the game really tries to hit you over the head with that, not just with the gameplay, but how it intertwines with the story. And I really like that. I like that synergy. It's not just like a gameplay gimmick. It's like something that was very intentional and is intertwined with the story. So like I said, you're not killing enemies, but you're kind of disarming them and they're running away. That will have significance because you will see characters again, and your change of heart will inspire their change of heart. And the idea of like seeing the light, and things change and times change and history versus now and getting perspective. There are a lot of really interesting characters in this game who are holding resentment or are seeing the world a certain way, and some of them realize their mistakes, some of them don't. So it's really interesting how it all plays together. And also it's a nice balance because there's some lightheartedness throughout the game. There are silly characters that have mannerisms. There's some fun dialogue. There's a lot of like recurring banter between NPCs that I found. And honestly, if you didn't go up and talk to them, you wouldn't even notice. But really interesting just how it's able to keep it lighthearted and still have some, you know, cheesy little jokes here and there. I feel like that just makes the game very well balanced and pleasant to be in the world and experience. Alright, let's wrap up the conversation about Bloodless. I really like this game, but let me tell you, it is a ball buster. And there were times where I wanted to throw a controller, but something about these games, I mean, I've played a ton of Bloodborne and Elden Ring and Sekiro, so like I'm used to, you know, having my head bashed in, but something about it just kept me coming back. I don't know if that's going to be for everyone, and that's okay. But I will say the onboarding in the first few hours is pretty good, but then you slam into a wall. Combat eventually requires you to lock in, to relinquish your stubbornness, to give in to what the game is trying to get you to do. Notice particular things instead of trying to brute force your way through. Again, could be headbanging for some. I was surprised midway through the game how much being a Souls player came in handy. Just the idea of mentally having that fortitude. Because you will definitely come across some frustrating encounters, but I will say the game is beatable. As long as you can adjust yourself and turn a new leaf or try to play the game as it's asking you to play it, it is beatable. Even the craziest encounters you come across for the first time, eventually you'll be able to get through it. But other than the difficulty, there's a lot else to love in here. It's a Japan explosion. Japanophiles are going to go crazy for this game, whether it's the visuals, the sounds, you know, the concepts or the themes, what's going on. Alongside that, great depth of upgrades, side content, hidden things that you can find, especially in the end game sort of area. You can go and beat the dojos and get a lot of upgrades. And in terms of value, I think 15 is an insanely great value for this game. For all that it has, it's really fun on Switch. I like it on Switch despite, you know, some chugging here and there. I really don't think you need to wait for a sale. I didn't wait for a sale for this game, and I have absolutely no regrets. Again, if this is the type of game in your wheelhouse, I think 15 is just a no-brainer for this game. I really do hope it comes to PS5. I would like to play it maybe even a second time and get those trophies, get that platinum trophy. That would be really nice, but honestly, I still find myself exploring and finding all the secrets in this game, which is nice. But like I said, this may be sort of a niche game, especially with the high difficulty. I think beginners in this genre, or just beginners to difficult games, you might pass on this game. But give it a look just in case, because I think there's a lot here. It's a great love letter to Japan and fans of games like Sekiro. So if you're into it, get ready for a challenge, because I recommend this game. Alright, that's going to wrap it up for this episode. Stay tuned for our next episode to see what new game we found for you.